The headline: Iran's president officially welcomes his Turkish counterpart, who is in Tehran for a trilateral summit involving Russia on the situation in Syria. Global oil prices rise after the return of U.S. President Joe Biden from Saudi Arabia, where he failed to persuade Riyadh to boost his oil output. And the European Union approves another 500 million euros to supply arms to Ukraine, taking the bloc's total financial support for Kiev to 2.5 billion euros. Thanks for joining us. Iran's president officially welcomes his Turkish counterpart, who is in Tehran to attend a trilateral summit on Syria's tensions. The two presidents and their Russian counterpart will hold the summit later on Tuesday. That is part of the Astana peace process, which was launched in 2017 at the initiative of Tehran, Moscow, and Ankara. The three top officials are planned to exchange viewpoints on how to reduce tensions and conflict zones in Syria. They will also discuss Syria's recent tensions with Turkey over its incursions into the Syrian territory. Iran has made a blistering attack on U.S. President Joe Biden over his latest rhetoric against the country's nuclear program.
Irony of our times. Just on the anniversary of the first U.S. nuke test, and after visiting an outlaw regime that possesses clandestine nukes, Mr. Biden stresses that he would not allow Iran to build bombs. Sales pitch to charm the Israeli apartheid regime by bombs that Iran has never sought.
Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani was referring to Biden's remarks during his recent West Asia tour that included a visit to Israel. Biden said in a meeting with the acting Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid in Tel Aviv that Washington would use force to stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. He later repeated his anti-Iran stance in Saudi Arabia on the second leg of his regional tour. Iran has time and again rejected allegations that it is in pursuit of nuclear weapons. Iran has also vowed a firm response to any military action against the Islamic Republic. On Monday, the naval commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps warned of a painful lesson to any act of aggression against the country. Brigadier General Alireza Tangsiri also said that Iran will nip the plots of the country's enemies in the bud. Journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas joined us earlier with his take on the main agenda of the U.S. president's recent trip to West Asia.
The world generally knows what the Americans are about. It's about the economic interests. It's about, as my colleague said, the interests of Israel primarily. And don't forget, there's also the challenge that they face on the surface, on the face of it. There is this so-called Eurasian axis, which is rising. So Russia, China, Iran being included within that is something that the Americans will argue that it compels them to actually have a stronger hand in West Asia. In reality, Saudi Arabia has actually been making noises, very positive noises for Russian support, and has also been very open to China. It could be argued, therefore, that Biden's mission, other than Israel, was also to secure and lock down Saudi Arabia. You know, Donald Trump talked about milking the cow, and milking Saudi Arabia is certainly something the Americans have been awfully good at over the decades, and they want to continue that until that oil runs out completely.
The United States says it will impose harsh consequences on countries that break or abuse what it calls the international economic order. The Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen hinted that Russia is challenging the order by its war in Ukraine. Yellen also said that the U.S. is pushing for increased trade ties with its allies to prevent what she called the manipulation of supply chains in the world. The official also called for a united stance against Russia's military operation in Ukraine. The U.S. accuses Russia of having triggered the current food crisis in the world by preventing Ukraine's key wheat exports. Moscow says it is the U.S. sanctions that have caused the crisis. The U.S. has also failed to form an international coalition for the trade embargo on Russia. The European Union approves another 500 million euros to supply arms to Ukraine, taking the bloc's total financial support for Kiev to 2.5 billion euros. There's growing disquiet in the bloc regarding the impact that sanctions against Russia are having on the EU's economy. Jerome Hughes has more from Brussels.
EU foreign affairs ministers held their last scheduled meeting on Monday before taking a six-week summer break. Of course, proceedings were dominated by the war in Ukraine.
Ukraine needs more arms. We will provide them. The war will continue. We'll continue supporting. And that's why I have proposed the next tranche of the European Peace Facility, allocating 500 million more.
Josep Borrell has doubled down on criticism of sanctions against Russia and their impact on EU citizens. He has even written a blog on the subject. It's reported he's doing this because of growing disquiet amongst EU leaders regarding the harm sanctions are causing. Energy and food prices continue to rise in the EU, placing enormous pressure on citizens. Experts warn things could get worse.
We have seen over the last couple of months that there is disparity, there is disunity. There is already an exception for Hungary in terms of energy supply. And my worry is that as soon as the winter sets in, that might be a problem, and then we have to see how long the support for the sanctions will materialise.
Ordinary citizens are asking why we don't hear more about peace negotiations.
The price you pay now is out of control. Gas, oil, electricity, food. It's all gone crazy. We need to end the war.
As the West continues to pump billions of euro and dollars into Ukraine, the country's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is sacking senior officials. Analysts say it shows the country remains corrupt at the highest levels. The European Commission will unveil much-anticipated plans on Wednesday, designed to ensure the EU doesn't run out of gas this winter. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
As Russia continues its advance in the eastern Ukrainian region of Donbas, Jenny Miller has traveled to a city which has seen some of the fiercest fighting of the war so far.
The city of Severodonetsk lies mostly in ruins. It was the scene of some of the fiercest fighting between the two armies. It now resembles a post-apocalyptic wasteland. At a military base, a pro-Russian fighter pulls down a Ukrainian sign. What's left of the city is now in Russian hands. On the outskirts of town, a grain silo. Russia and Ukraine blame each other for bombing it. Now, this may well be one of the most tragic places that I've been to in this war, because millions of people around the world may well go hungry due to this conflict because of the huge amounts of grain that Ukraine exports in usual times around the world. For those people, it won't really matter whether it was Russia or Ukraine who committed this strike. Humanity is bombing its own food supplies. Unsurprisingly, few people remain in the city. Those that do are keen to tell of what they saw.
The Ukrainians knew where people lived. They drove around looking for people's houses. And when they fled, they occupied their houses and started firing. We live in that house, and they were firing from there for 3 weeks.
It wasn't all done by Russia. It was done by Ukraine. There are witnesses who saw tanks driving up and firing at house just like that.
While NATO and Ukraine blame Russia for the devastation, the strange truth is that everyone I spoke to here is more critical of Ukraine.
Ukraine acted in a sly way. They would bring a howitzer here, fire, and then leave. Then Russia would strike, and they would say Russia is bombing civilians. They were occupying kindergartens and would fire from there.
They made them sit in the basement and took over their flats. They put mortars on the roofs and fired. We don't know what Russia did. We didn't see them until we returned.
While Russia and Ukraine continue to blame each other for the devastation wrought by this conflict, there remains little appetite for peace. The longer this war goes on, the more of Ukraine will be destroyed, and the greater the threat to world food supplies and the global economy. Johnny Miller, Severodonetsk.
An amber warning for extreme heat issued in the UK, a country with a policy to rapidly reduce climate-damaging greenhouse gas emissions. But, as Said Pourreza reports, combination of a cost-of-living crisis and the need to find a new prime minister is calling into question Britain's commitment to reaching net zero by the year 2050.
The British capital is boiling with July temperatures rarely seen in the country. For some, it's business as usual, a chance to bask in it. For others, a cause for concern.
I would say climate changing. Every year, it's just getting hotter and hotter. In other countries like Dubai and Kuwait, that's 50, 60 degrees. That's normal nowadays.
Basically, we let it go like downhill for like 200 years, for example. And now we just, we're doing something wrong here, you know. But at least the realization is a first step. So hopefully they will take it more serious and start actually doing something.
With temperatures climbing up to 41 degrees Celsius over the next 2 days, the National Meteorological Service has issued its first ever red warning for exceptional heat for much of the country.
Britain is a country where people are used to complaining about the wet weather. Now this scorching heat is going to give them something else to gripe about. But it doesn't stop there. There's real concern about how these rising temperatures will impact the everyday life.
Metro passengers have been urged not to travel by train. Schools are only allowing early pickups after the government said they had to stay open and that people should be resilient enough to enjoy the sunshine. Climate activists are threatening more decisive action to perceived inaction by government and big business, similar to the Extinction Rebellion protest that shut down parts of central London a few years ago. The activists' frustration now confirmed by the UK's climate minister, Alok Sharma, who has accused some of the candidates running for prime minister of being lukewarm on achieving the country's net zero target. And this week, his plea for climate action as he addressed the Petersburg climate dialogue in Berlin.
I have to say, and I say this with all sincerity, that many of the commitments that we heard in Glasgow remain just that. They are still just words on a page. And you know, because you can see this around you, all the evidence tells us that time is running out.
Climate scientists say the next decade will be defined by greater weather extremes. But the fear is it'll also be shaped by humanity's collective failure to do more. Saeed Purizza, London.
Shia Muslims are celebrating Eid al-Qadir. The festivity marks the appointment of Ali ibn Abi Talib as the next Muslim leader after the Prophet Muhammad. From Tehran, our correspondent Yusuf Jalali has this report.
Everyone is invited to this party that stretches for 10 kilometers in Tehran. As Shia Muslims around the world are marking Eid al-Qadir, Iranians have got together in this festival to share the happy mood with each other.
This beautiful celebration has drawn many Iranians to enjoy Eid al-Qadir festivity together. I congratulate all my fellow Muslims on the Eid.
Happy Eid al-Qadir to all Muslims. We Shia Muslims regard this festivity as a chance to renew our allegiance with Imam Ali, our first Imam.
Eid al-Qadir marks the beginning of Shia Islam some 14 centuries ago, when Prophet Muhammad appointed Ali ibn Abi Talib, the first Shia Imam, as his successor and Muslims' next leader.
On Eid al-Qadir, Prophet Muhammad raised Imam Ali's hand and said, "Whoever am their leader, Ali is their leader too." The Prophet was on his way back from his last Hajj pilgrimage, where he was accompanied by many people.
Imam Ali was the cousin of Prophet Muhammad and is known as the first man to embrace the Prophet's call for Islam. According to Islamic references, Imam Ali rooted out poverty and promoted an unprecedented justice system across the Muslim world during his short rule based in Iraq's city of Kufa.
Imam Ali represents justice, humanity, and chivalry. During his rule, he eliminated sexual and racial discrimination and promoted kindness.
Here, not only do Iranians celebrate Eid al-Qadir, they get to teach their kids about who Imam Ali was.
I named my son after Imam Ali. It's not just about his name. I like him to act and behave like Imam Ali. That's why I brought him to this ceremony. Imam Ali is a role model for all of us.
In Shia Islam, there are 12 imams or religious leaders, all believed to have preserved the legacy of the Prophet. Mahdi is the last imam, who is believed to be the apocalyptic savior of the world and is currently living in occultation.
To Muslims, Eid al-Qadir is a time when God perfected their religion by introducing Imam Ali as their next leader. That's why they celebrate it every year to honor Imam Ali as the father of Shia Islam, a symbol of Islamic justice. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Muslims in Indian-controlled Kashmir are celebrating Eid al-Qadir. The event marks the Prophet Muhammad's latest, or last sermon, that is, after the Hajj pilgrimage some 1,400 years ago, when he introduced Imam Ali as his successor. Shana Bhatt reports from Kashmir.
Muslims, particularly the Shia community in the Indian-administered Kashmir, have marked Eid al-Qadir by sending the message of peace across the Muslim world. Congregational ceremonies took place in different parts of the region as a reminder to tell Muslims to live in harmony and brotherhood. One of the largest gatherings in central Kashmir was attended by the leading Muslim scholars, wherein prominent Shia and Sunni figures spoke about the significance of Prophet Muhammad's last sermon.
By pointing fingers at each other, we are doing no service to our religion Islam. For the success of Islam and the teachings of the Prophet and his progeny, we have to take the route of unity. United under the flag of Islam, we shall gain freedom for Al-Quds.
Eid al-Ghadir marks the anniversary of Prophet Muhammad's sermon, in which he appointed Imam Ali as his successor.
Muslims must understand the importance of Ghadir, be it Shia or Sunni Muslims. Ghadir teaches us the importance of leadership. Unfortunately, the Muslims in the present world order are divided just because we are leaderless. Thus, this day is the reminder of our beloved Prophet's sermon, his ahead-of-time warnings, and the glad tidings.
The occasion is marked on the 18th of Zilhajj in the lunar Islamic calendar.
Each year, Eid al-Ghadir is marked by Muslims in Kashmir with reassertion to stay committed to the religion of Islam and teachings and beliefs of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
And that is for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی
In the path of the Imam
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, it was said that Imam Khomeini protested to the ratification of the scandalous bill known as capitulation in the Iranian parliament in 1963. The ratification of this bill would grant American nationals absolute immunity before law. In other words, if a U.S. national committed a crime in Iran, the Iranian judiciary could not prosecute and punish him, and he should be transferred to his country to be dealt with. After the bill was passed into a law at the Iranian parliament, Imam Khomeini castigated the regime of Shah and was soon arrested and sent to exile to Turkey. Today, we are going to touch upon the events after. Stay tuned, please. After sending Imam Khomeini to exile to Turkey, his family didn't hear from him for 5 months. The Imam's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, says, "When the Imam was arrested, we didn't have any information of him for 5 months. At last, I lost my patience and told Mr. Ishraqi, 'How long should we be uninformed? Perhaps they have killed the Imam and Mustafa. Shouldn't we be informed? You and Mr. Pasandide should do something. They have taken two people from my family, my husband and my son. My distress was reported to the Savak, and after a few days, there was a message to assure us that these two people are alive and to make sure we could choose a person to meet them. We intended to send the Imam's brother, Mr. Pasandide, but it was not accepted, and thus we agreed to send the son-in-law of Ayatollah Khansari and another man whom had been chosen by the regime. Nearly 6 months after Imam Khomeini's arrest and exile, his first letter was received whereby he had informed the family of his health. In part of the letter, he had written, 'Thank God I am fine. Don't be worried at all. Whatever Almighty God has ordained is good and will happen. Yet it may be that you dislike something while it is good for you. Thank God Mustafa is fine and there is no worry. I am just a little worried as I don't hear from you. I entrust you to God Almighty. If you write a letter, let all children write a few words themselves.'" Lady Saghafi continues, "Each one of us wrote a letter in a few lines. It was just greetings and sent it with a can of Sohan candy to Turkey. But the agents of regime didn't let it reach Bursa, the place of Imam's exile, because they didn't want to disclose his residence for Iranians, especially the students abroad. The Imam and Mustafa were taken to Istanbul, and they met with them in Istanbul. They met with each other and gave the answer to the letters were given very briefly. Yet these letters were like the spirit breathed into our body." Imam Khomeini's wife relates, "When Mustafa entered Bursa, he found his father in a room with curtains drawn. He immediately draws the curtains away. In front of the room, there was a roughly large and pleasant yard. His father laughs at him, saying, 'I have been in this room for 2 months, but I didn't draw the curtains away as I didn't want them to think that I am tired of this condition. You drew them away as soon as you came.' Then they both laughed." Imam Khomeini added, "I haven't looked through the curtains even once, although I was alone in the room." During his exile in Turkey, Imam Khomeini was taken to Izmir to visit the cemetery of many Sunni scholars who had been killed because of opposing the programs of Ataturk. This visit had been planned by Savak to intimidate Imam Khomeini. Lady Saghafi continues, "In Turkey, once the Imam and Mustafa were taken to Izmir, the Imam used to repeat this sentence that The day when we reached Izmir, somewhere we saw many tombs as mass graves. I asked, "What is this?" The Turkish security head answered, "When Ataturk revolted against religion, the ulema rose up against him and Ataturk killed all of them, and some of them were buried here," Imam Khomeini said. I told myself the Turkish Sunni scholars rose up against Ataturk and all were killed, but no scholar has been killed during the recent events in Iran. No one had been killed till then. The Imam related this story bitterly several times. Imam Khomeini was in exile in Turkey nearly for 1 year. Then he was sent to Najaf in Iraq. The Pahlavi regime wanted to eclipse the Imam's greatness and influence before great ulema such as Grand Ayatollahs Hakim, Khoi, Shahrudi and Shirazi. Ms. Saghafi recounts the story. The Imam said, "Once the Turkish security agents came along with the head of security of Bursa, saying, 'Would you like to go to Najaf?' On one hand, it would be good, but on the other hand, it was not good to accept my exile personally, even if it was to Najaf. I asked them to give me time to think on it. But they came the day after and said that I had to go to Najaf. I said, 'Whatever happens is good.' So they brought us from Bursa to Istanbul and then to Baghdad." Imam Khomeini was taken to Iraq secretly and under tough security measures. But after entering Baghdad, the Imam and his son, Haj Aga Mustafa, went to Kazemain to visit the shrine of Imam Musa Kazem and Imam Muhammad Taqi, peace upon them. At the shrine of Imam Musa Kazem, some of the Iranians recognized the Imam, and the news were quickly spread among the people, and very soon, many seminary students came toward the Imam. Imam Khomeini stayed in the cities of Samarra and Karbala for a few days, and then came to Najaf. But his family was unaware of his transfer from Turkey to Iraq. 10 days later, they received a letter from him and were no more concerned. Ms. Saghafi says, "We would hear for 1 week that the Imam had been taken to Najaf, but we were not certain. We asked the Savak, but they would not answer to disturb us. They would not send the telegram either. And it would take at least 15 days for a letter to reach the destitution. Finally, after 10 days of rumors on the issue, I received a letter from him to know that he was in Najaf."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
I'm Kavit Ahlai. The war in Ukraine is moving full steam ahead. One of the developments, energy warnings from the IEA, the International Energy Agency, who has said that a potentially disastrous natural gas supply crunch this winter awaits Europe. due to the possibility of Russia cutting off gas supplies completely. Then there's a warning from the former Russian President Medvedev that an attack on Crimea will ignite, quote, Judgment Day response. Meanwhile, several high-profile suspensions have taken place in Ukraine, while Russia is targeting Ukraine's missiles as Western-supplied weapons bite. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Journalist and political commentator Fred Weir joins us from Moscow. Then we have the president of the European Institute for International Law and International Relations, Mahmoud Rafat, who joins us from Stockholm.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Fred Weir, let me first start with you. The former Russian president, Dmitry Medvedev, has issued a warning that I thought would set the stage for this program, in which he said attack on Crimea will ignite, quote, Judgment Day response. Judgment Day will come very hard, very fast and hard. It will be very difficult to hide. Tell us, give us context of that and what he's talking about, what he means.
Well, I think the key here is the American threat to provide long-range missiles. They're providing these multiple launch missiles, you know, the HIMARS they're called, with shorter ranges, like 30 to up to 70 kilometers. But there is a version of this weapon system that has missiles that go up to 300 kilometers. And the Ukrainians have explicitly threatened to use them against Crimea. And Crimea is, besides its symbolic importance to Ukraine, it is a target-rich environment. It has the Russian naval base at Sevastopol and several key military zones. So I think this threat is something the Russians take pretty seriously. And I'm guessing that warning is directed, not directly, but symbolically at Washington. They're trying to tell the Americans, don't supply this type of weaponry to the Ukrainians because it will be a major escalation. Otherwise, I don't know what Judgment Day might mean. I mean, the Russians do have the ability to destroy a lot of targets inside Ukraine, and they are doing it. But Judgment Day is a religious term, and I don't really know what specific sort of escalation they're threatening. But it sounds chilling, that's for sure.
Mahmoud Rafat, I'll put this into context as to how some have been reporting this, in which Medvedev was said not to elaborate, but has previously warned the U.S. to put it in this context, of the dangers of attempting to punish a nuclear power like Russia over its action in Ukraine. Do you think that the U.S. is pushing Russia's buttons to that point?
Well, obviously, the American side gave intelligence information about the places of Russian generals, which caused killing 17 generals, and this stopped by direct orders or instructions from President Biden, which means, yes, there are somehow Americans pushing both Ukraine and Europeans against Russia, and not in a Russian way, because we have to also remember there is international law, and this international law gives Ukraine the right to join the NATO, but on the ground that not feasible, especially for the Russian side, which they consider it big threat to them, to the security, national security of Russia, and they would never admit it. So not only the international law will manage the case or the file in front of us today, but will be somehow powers who will talk in next few weeks, and we will see the escalation will arrive until which point if the American side continues supporting Kiev.
Well, not to just zoom in on this issue, but I think it's pretty important since we have opened up the program with it. And Fred Weir, I'm curious whether the U.S. has to discuss or get permission from other NATO members when it wants to, when it provides Ukraine with this HIMARS, what do you call it, a HIMARS missile system? Is that what it's called? Where it, as you said, has a 300-kilometer range? Because based on that, my next question then would be, what if one lands in Crimea, or two, or how many would it take for Russia to react? This is for Fred Weir. Go ahead, Fred Weir. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The HIMARS system, it is one system, but it has different types of ammunition. They are already providing, I mean, the Americans are already providing these systems to Ukraine. They're already in action in the Donbass. Apparently, there are a dozen or so of them already in Ukraine. But that type of ammunition, which is the high-end, the long-range missiles, are not yet being provided. And it would be, I think it would be a step beyond for the Americans to do so, except that we've already had this exchange of opinions. The Ukrainians have said, we will target Crimea, which we consider to be Ukrainian territory, not Russian. And the United States, officially, I haven't got the quote to hand, but they did officially say that they wouldn't consider Crimea to be Russian territory because they have forbidden Ukrainians to use these weapons against Russian territory. But both the United States and Ukraine doesn't consider Crimea Russian territory. Therefore, I think some sort of fix is in, and that in Washington they are contemplating this very escalation. And it would be pretty serious, as that quote, that rather obscure, vague quote from Medvedev clearly implies, the Russians would regard that as a serious escalation, and they would react in some way. And we don't know what that would be, but, you know, everything like this draws us a little closer to World War III than we would like to be.
Sure. Well, Mr. Rafat, on the political side, within Ukraine, there was a development that was pretty strange in the way it was first presented and then retracted, in a sense, where President Volodymyr Zelensky was reported first abruptly firing the head of Ukraine's powerful domestic security agency called the SBU, then the state prosecutor general, in which it cited dozens of cases actually of collaboration with Russia by officials in those agencies. But then the news came out that they have been suspended pending investigations, not formally dismissed. What do you make of that development?
Well, I think there is somehow a contradiction in the behavior of President Zelensky, because he fired the top officials of intelligence and the prosecutor as well, general prosecutor of Ukraine, because there he accused them, or he said their employees are working for the Russian, which is considered enemy of Ukraine for the moment. While that cannot be applied on the ground, that cannot be imagined on the ground to happen, because these people, either they were blocked there, or they were imprisoned, or whatever we call their statute, but not working for Russian side. This is not imaginable even to work for the Russian side. But in my opinion, President Zelensky expected more investigation or more result of the war crimes and crimes against humanity, etc., of this chain of crimes the Kiev prosecution addressed to the Russian side. And both the intelligence service with the prosecution did not fulfill his wishes to gather as much as he wanted to present them to the International Criminal Court or to start with other Western governments in this case, the case of crimes, war crimes, and crimes against humanity they accused Russia to had committed. In my opinion, this is the main reason, the failure of the two structures or two organizations to fulfill the wishes of President Zelensky in these cases.
How do you see that, Fred? I mean, some are looking at this being maybe on a larger scale to happen because as the war drags on, as the country is suffering as immensely as it is, that you're going to see more dissent maybe in a sense to happen in Ukraine. Do you see this as a sign of that?
I think it's a very worrisome.
No, this is Fred Weir. Go ahead, Fred Weir. I'm sorry.
It's extremely worrisome. It's not just the two top officials who've been suspended. They haven't been accused of treason. But there are ongoing almost 700 treason cases in Ukraine. And this something Zelensky mentioned in his statement. There's 660 cases of treason within the state apparatus, the SBU, the military, other institutions, and there are 60 cases of officials in occupied territories who have gone to work for the Russians. This is totally believable, by the way, and I don't know about all the treason cases and so on, but you have a regime that is now clearly terrified of its own shadow. This scale of arrests for and treason charges is not a sign of a unified government in any way. So it's extremely worrisome, and it's the kind of thing that starts to get out of hand when you've got that many people clearly being suspected of treason and on trial under arrest, and you've got police, secret police, and others looking for such enemies. This kind of thing has a way of snowballing. It is really, really worrisome. I have no idea what is going on in Kiev, but people should be paying much closer attention to it.
Well, there's another point of concern for Ukraine, Mr. Rafat, and that is whether it's going to continue getting the support that it has been. And I'm going to put these two developments into one, forge it into one for you, where there's one piece of news that talks about what it termed EU fatigue, where the EU foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, actually had to make a statement saying some European leaders have been saying that the sanctions were an error, they were a mistake, in which he says, we don't think it was a mistake. And then you have the get-together of the foreign ministers just today to show that the bloc can maintain its financial and military support, pledging more support for Ukraine. Of course, this is as their own citizens are suffering. Do you think that there's fatigue within the EU countries for prolonging this war?
Well, for sure, there's a fatigue. We can not now. The exchange rate of the euro for first time in its history to fall down in front of the dollar and to lose big percentage of its value and to become less than even $1 today after it was like $1.20. This is a big sign of fatigue of the economy as well. And we mustn't forget the most important point that the industry of Europe is really threatened and seriously threatened because of the suspension of Russian gas. Meanwhile, Russia is a big market for the European products. So there are on several levels. But we need to understand at the same time the kind of relation between Europe and the United States since the Second World War. Since the end of the Second World War, Europe did not build an army. Europe did not build real independency of the United States protection system. So when we talk about the NATO, we talk about United States decision. And it's very clear for the administration of President Biden is insisting to continue the war with any price, to be from the European side or from the Russian side. And the Europeans will not be able to get out of this dilemma as long as the President Biden administration still, and we still have 3 years for this administration. So as long as the administration Biden is there, the war, I think, we will not be able to stop it despite the fatigue and despite the consequences Europe is paying. We are feeling today worldwide, maybe, but in Europe in particular, the dramatic increase of prices, the threat of industries, as I just mentioned, to be stopped because of the gas, lots of things we have in Europe. But Europe will not be able to dispatch from the United States decision because of the nature of the relationship since the end of the Second World War in 1945 until today, and will continue like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it remains to be seen how much of this relationship is going to continue in its bond, because when you have a warning coming from the IEA, for example, Fred Weir, where European nations, it said, must take urgent action to avert a potentially disastrous natural gas supply crunch. And the biggest one that I could think of, Fred Weir, is the one that was issued by Germany, where even the government said that, people have to maybe cope to turn to wood as a heating source for this winter. And plus, we know that Nord Stream 1 is actually under repair, where Russia now says, well, if we want to open it back up, we need to talk about lifting of sanctions. How worried should Europe be?
Yes, very worried. There are so many aspects of these sanctions that have boomeranged. But on the energy front, that is the biggest single, I don't know what you'd call it, goal or something that the West has inflicted. So it is remarkable that in the meeting you referenced today, they did not impose any new energy-related sanctions. It is clear that the winter is not that far away, and natural gas reservoirs are not anywhere near full, and therefore this is a problem that is focusing minds for sure right now. I don't know what this leads to. What I fear, to come back to your original question, I fear further escalations, some news. You know how this happens? Some terrible thing happens, an atrocity, a huge war crime, something just comes up and completely changes the public atmosphere and ratchets up the confrontation. This is a very dangerous time, and it's not a static thing, this Ukraine fatigue or whatever. I think we're in the midst of a very fluid situation, one in which the standoff between Russia and the West can turn very nasty very quickly. And so I don't know, I wake up every morning in sheer terror of what I might find when I start reading the news.
So what's going to trigger that? I mean, since you spoke that way, what would trigger that World War III scenario?
Yeah, well, Ukrainians attacking Crimea with heavy missiles and the Russians retaliating in some way. Because what could the Russians do? They could retaliate against the NATO staging grounds where they're bringing weaponry into Ukraine, right on the border there. It seems likely that in recent attacks the Russians have killed foreign officers. I don't think this is well noticed, but an attack on an officers' club in Vinnytsia the other day appears to have killed foreign military officers who were there consulting with their Ukrainian colleagues. This sort of thing, because NATO forces, especially Polish forces, are so much more involved in Ukraine and inside Ukraine, and on the border where weapons are being, transported every day, you can easily get an attack where Russians will hit NATO forces, and we will find ourselves in the midst of a hot war.
Sure. Well, since our guest there is from Stockholm, Sweden, I'd like to ask you, in terms of the application made by Sweden and Finland, and what your thoughts are about their desire and eagerness to join NATO.
Of Sweden, honestly, it's an old desire. Maybe it was pushed up by the war now between Russia and Ukraine, but this desire existed, and there were lots of voices calling to join NATO, but that was not really priority in Sweden. We know Sweden did not get involved in any war since more than 200 years, since 1814, did not get involved in any war. So despite that, Sweden was somehow motivated to go to the NATO since, especially after the end of the Cold War, 1990 of last century. So this is all desire. But now I estimate it somehow came with rush. This step came with rush. Sweden would better to wait at least until the end of this year, because until today we do not know what is the limit of the escalation. Shall Russian side use a nuclear as threatened with, or it will limit its military action and military operation on what's running on the ground. Employing the pressures against a nuclear power must be managed differently, in my opinion. Russia is a nuclear power. You cannot put it under such pressure. So that's why we did not know the escalation will arrive to where. This right. is the point for the moment.
Well, final question goes to you, Fred Weir. This is what's worrying, to add to the sentiment that you have, when you have the Ukrainian foreign minister saying that the condition for peace talks with Moscow is, when it comes to having negotiations, it will only make sense only after Russia's defeat on the battlefield. Does he really understand what that means, defeating Russia on the battlefield, when he makes a statement like that?
Well, it does look increasingly phantasmagoric. The battlefield is gradually shaping up in Russia's favor. They're in the Donbass. They are grinding through the main Ukrainian army, step by step, town by town, trench by trench. And that is where most of the Ukrainian regular army is. They're heavily fortified, but they are getting defeated. And you can talk about future offensives and all kinds of Western weaponry that will be coming in. But basically, once Ukraine has lost its regular forces, it can't really replace them. So something has to break, and it probably will before the end of summer.
All right. Hot summer ahead of us. Fred Weir from Moscow, journalist and political commentator. Thank you. And thank you, Mahmoud Rafat, president at the European Institute for International Law and International Relations from Stockholm. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vitavi and the team, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, everyone. Welcome to Arab English Radio. This is Asma, your humble host for today's episode, and you're hearing me from Q&A on Islamic Belief, where you could get the answers to all your questions. Well, today we have Dr. Karimi, scholar of religious studies, who will help us with the answers. Assalamu alaikum and welcome, Dr. Karimi.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Well, the question for today's episode goes for the concept that sometimes it happens to some people that they go through the verses of the Holy Book of Quran and it doesn't move them. It does not have any effect upon them. Though we know that whoever who goes to that Holy Book would feel a sort of attachment, a sort of effect that comes directly from the verses to the heart of the person who's reading them. So how do you justify that, and what's the problem with those people?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The same question sometimes is asked about other acts of worship as well. Many people ask and say that we say the prayers, salat, but we do not enjoy that and we do not see any effect on us.
We don't feel anything.
We do not feel anything. First of all, the first point is that I believe that we cannot claim that there is no effect. I mean, automatically speaking, there might be and there must be some spiritual effects, but we are not able to understand, and at least we will be rewarded.
Exactly.
I mean, by reciting the verses, by saying the prayer, at least there is a kind of reward in the hereafter, and this is a big effect, at least. But spiritually speaking, what are some of the impediments for us feeling that we are not affected by the verses of the Quran or by saying the prayers? There are a couple of points. First of all is the lack of knowledge and understanding. So when it comes to the verses of the Quran, sometimes me as an ordinary person who does not know anything about Arabic language recite the Quran, and sometimes Imam Ali alayhi salam is reciting the Quran with all those vast knowledges and everything. So
there must be a difference.
And when it comes to us human beings, I mean fallible human beings, the first point is that is it only reading the Quran like a parrot without paying attention to the meaning? If this is the case, we cannot expect